Okay, so welcome to ASPConf, the virtual ASP.NET conference. I'm pretty happy to be delivering my first session at ASPConf, last year MVCConf. And the session is titled Brewing Beer with Windows Azure. So what I'm going to tell you about is well, basically how you can build a website on Windows Azure, hook up temperature sensors, authenticate your sensors against your website, authenticate third-party API users against your website. So really a lot of topics in a session of 1 hour and 50 minutes, I think. If you haven't joined, please join the Jabber link you see on the slides in the left lower hand corner. You can ask questions in there. If you have comments, feel free to put them there. I'm monitoring this chat room during the talk, so if you have something to ask, just put it in there and I'll make sure that we can answer the question. Let's start by introducing myself. I am Maarten Maljouw. I work for Real Dolmen and I am based in Antwerp, Belgium. Now in Antwerp, and I see there's a couple of Belgians in the attendee list, so this may be interesting. In Antwerp, we have a saying where we say Antwerp is the center of the world. So I actually went to Bing and search for Antwerp, and this is what I got. So Antwerp is indeed the center of the world according to Bing. So now you also know where I'm based and what time it may be here. I start at 4 p.m. the session. My focus is mainly on web, ASP.NET MVC, Windows Azure, SignalR, basically anything related to operating a website and building a website. I have been an MVP in ASP.NET. I've been in Windows Azure MVP for the past 2 years, and since this year, I'm also an ASP Insider. On those topics, you can find a lot of blog posts on my blog. I try to blog weekly or bi-weekly on those topics. On Twitter, I'm a little more active. You can find a lot of links to topics related to ASP.NET MVC, Windows Azure, SignalR, etc. If I'm in traffic and if I'm having to commute to my work, you will also see me complaining a lot about traffic in Belgium. So please bear with me if you see those, because there's a lot of interesting links, at least according to me, that will pass on Twitter as well. Also, I'm going to commercially plug some things I've been doing. I've been writing a book called Pro NuGet together with a colleague. If you're interested in NuGet, please go to Amazon, buy our book, so we can buy some additional beer ingredients and do some additional brewing there. We've also been building MyGet, which is a NuGet as a service site on which you can host your private NuGet feeds and add packages to that for use in your enterprise. Okay, enough commercials. Well, the agenda for today. First of all, I'm going to tell you a little bit about how you can brew beer and what brewing beer is all about. Afterwards, I will be talking to you about BrewBuddy, our application we've been building to manage recipes, manage your brews, etc. We've been building that one on top of Windows Azure websites, so I'm going to tell a little bit about that as well. I'm also going to talk to you about Service Bus and the access control service related to it because, well, BrewBuddy is our website on which you can also monitor your fermentation process of your brewing. So we kind of hooked up some sensors to BrewBuddy, and we're using Service Bus and access control service to connect the sensors to our website. And also, since a lot of websites nowadays are exposing their data as an API, we also thought about building an API. So I'm also going to show you how you can do that and how you can securely expose it. Again, if you're not on Jabber, please join because I will be monitoring the chat room over there. And if you have any questions on the session contents, any remarks, feel free to post them there. And if I can do it, I will answer some questions during the session. So let's turn some water into beer. How do you brew beer? How do you go to a nice looking brown or white beer from water and from the ingredients you have available? Well, how I started my hobby of brewing beer, that was because of this guy, which is Wade Wegner. If you don't know him, he's one of the original hosts of the Cloud Cover show. And if you're interested in Windows Azure, you should know the Cloud Cover show on Channel 9. And he's actually also a home brewer. Now, I've been talking to Wade Wenger on the MVP Summit in 2011, and he was telling me about his home brewing hobby, and well, it was kind of interesting and so on, but I never did something with it. Then this year again, MVP Summits, I met Wade Wenger again, and he was talking about his home brewing hobby again. So I actually got interested a little bit more in brewing your own beers. So yeah, he convinced me into starting brewing. So the process of brewing, well, there's actually a couple of processes. There's roughly two ways of brewing beer. You can find on the internet some starter kits which contain cans containing malt extracts. And you have to add water to it, you have to add sugar to it, let it fermentate, and then afterwards you have your beer. Now, the problem with that is it's not really your own beer. You have to really build your own beer with malt, and you can't do that with those malt extracts. So I chose to brew with malt extracts. So the first step in the brewing process is getting your kegs clean. So you see those two white buckets. You will need one of those to have your beer fermentate and well, convert the sugar in it to alcohol. Next thing you have to do is weigh your ingredients. So what you see is two bags of malt extract. And you can add those to your beer. You have to mix the hops in. You have to add some extra hops during the boiling of the ingredients. So that's the next thing you do. You boil the ingredients for about 1 hour and a half just to make sure that all the sugar that is inside the malt is being extracted into the liquids that you are going to convert into beer. Now, after boiling, you have to pour it into a keg, and it looks like this. A little bit pale, a little bit, well, it's not very lively, but that is going to be your beer. If you have that, you have to let it cool down because, well, of course, you've boiled it in the previous step, so you can't really have your beer fermentate above 30 or 25 centigrades or something. So you have to make sure it's cooled down somewhere between 20 and 26 centigrades, and then you can add the yeast. So the yeast comes in small packages, and you have to mix those packages with the yeast, with water, and then add the yeast to your brew. Then after that, well, there's a lot of rinsing to do. You have to clean up all the kegs that you have been using to cook your beer. You have to clean up everything related to the malt extracts, and that's really sticky. But you have to do it because otherwise your wife acceptance factor goes down, and that will be your first and your last brew if you do it. So you have to really clean it up. Then after that, you have to wait for fermentation to complete. So you have to put that keg in a dark location and add the water lock on top of it. So the thing you see on the picture on the right is a water lock. Which ensures that no outside air can interfere with the beer. But the beer contains yeast. The yeast will produce CO2. So the CO2 will try to escape through the water lock. But then again, you don't want it to have access to the outside air. So that's why the water lock is there. So after the fermentation, which takes, well, 1 week or 10 days, you go into the next steps. You pour the beer into another keg. And why would you do it? Because the first keg in which you did the fermentation contains, well, a lot of garbage. It contains rests of the hops, it contains rests of the malt. So you really have to put it in another keg just to make sure that this dirty stuff doesn't get into your beer because that will ruin the taste afterwards. Next thing you do is wait another week for all the sediments to settle down on the bottom of the second keg. And then you can start bottling. So then you can finally put the beer in a bottle. Now, before you do that, you have to add a little bit of sugar because during the bottling, that additional sugar is going to convert into CO2, which will be the gas which you require to have foam on top of the beer. And then you're happy. So you think you are happy. And the first time, this was actually my first brew, this picture. And I look really happy on the picture because I was thinking, yes, the beer is finished. But afterwards, there's a really, really difficult part, which is waiting 6 weeks at least for the beer to age. More is better, but at least 6 weeks. So roughly brewing beer until it's ready to drink is about 8 weeks. So you have to think about that and well, maybe have a number of beers in the lagering phase, so you always have some beer that you brewed to consume directly. Now, on the chat room, I see a question, and I actually have it on my slides as well. What does this have to do with Windows Azure? Nothing yet. Panayotis, a colleague of mine, also a Windows Azure MVP, and I, we've been building brewbuddy.net, which is really a website to Azureify the home brewer. We do social brewing. So what we do on this website is we have some public recipes. So if you have a beer recipe, you built your own beer, you can publish your own recipe on our website. People can see it. They will be able to rate it afterwards and stuff like that. So really social brewing. Also, if you want to keep track of your own recipes, you can publish them on BrewBuddy as well, but as a private recipe, and they will not be available to the general public, but you can still track your own recipe. Now, based on one of those recipes, either a public one or a private one, you can create your own brew. So, whenever you are starting the process of converting water into beer, you start a brew and you can create a brew from a recipe. You can track the status, you can add comments, and you can link a sensor to it to keep track of the temperature during fermentation. So let's give you a quick demo about BrewBuddy. So let's go to brewbuddy.net. Here's our website. You can go to it on www.brewbuddy.net and you will see this one. We have a nice welcome page with a nice hero unit. There's public recipes on there, so you can see a Rochefort-inspired Targ Strong on there, which you can copy to your own recipes, which you can brew. Basically, you can do anything with it. This is a public recipe. Now, I can also go and log in using my username and passwords. And I can log in, and once I'm logged in, I have my own recipes as well. So I can create my own recipes, I can create a new recipe, I can edit a recipe. It supports Markdown, so for the ingredients, for example, or for the instructions, you can add Markdown, and that will render nicely on your recipe page. And you can choose to publish it in the public recipe gallery as well. So let's save it. And then you'll see this one. Next thing I can do is brew it, and then I will be able to create a new brew from this one. I already have some brews, and you will see that I have finished three brews already. I can look into it, I can add some comments in there, I can track the status. And also, if I link a temperature sensor to it, you will see a nice temperature profile. Of the temperature during fermentation. Now, if you see this on our website on your live beer, if you see this, you are brewing Heineken. That's Dutch beer. In Belgium, we don't like Dutch beer. Actually, I'm wondering if anyone likes Dutch beer. But yeah, this is the temperature profile for a Heineken. So you don't want to see this during your actual brewing process. You want a nice flat line. Coming in there. So that's our website. It's still pretty basic, but the basics are there. You can track your brew, you can track your recipe, so you can actually use it today to track your home brew. Also on the chats, I see Dutch beer shouldn't even be allowed to be called beer, so I agree with that. Pretty sure the Dutch don't agree, but then again. Okay, so the architecture for our website is also pretty easy. We have our public website running on Windows Azure websites, which have been released last month on June 7th, I believe. And they allow you to publish your website from Visual Studio, from WebMatrix, from wherever you want to publish it. And it's really easy to use them, but it's also really cheap to use them. Now, within those Windows Azure websites, if you require a database like us to store your recipes and to store your brews, what you can do is basically have SQL Compact Edition in there and host your database in Windows Azure websites as well. We decided to not take that route, and we decided to use the SQL Azure database to store all the backend data. So you can combine Windows Azure website with a SQL Azure database without a problem, but we just wanted to make sure we had a real SQL server sitting in the back instead of just SQL Compact. On the other end, we have some sensors, which can be whatever. On my PC, and you will see that one later in the talk, I have, well, I can actually show it. I have this nice beer icon here on my lower right in my task tree. And this one is actually monitoring my current brew. And that's a Windows Forms application just sitting in my task tree. Now, a colleague of mine from our Azure user group, our Windows Azure user group in Belgium, he's built a .NET micro framework sensor, and he's also linked that one to BrewBuddy. So that one works as well. So the sensor can be basically anything that can report data from a temperature sensor into our system. Now, how does it report data into our system? Well, using a service bus topic. So Windows Azure has this concept of service bus, which is a service that you can use to queue messages. So what the sensor does is it just throws in a lot of data. So every 20 seconds, it will put its readings into a service bus topic, which will collect all that data for me. Then on the other hand, we have a worker role sitting in Windows Azure, which is collecting the data from the service bus topic and writing it in an aggregated form in our SQL Azure database. So if you go to the website, the temperature readings that you are seeing are not real time. Those are averages over 10 minutes, while the sensor is reporting data, I think, 3 or 4 times a minute. So our worker role is really aggregating that one and putting it in our database. So Windows Azure websites. Well, Windows Azure websites are new in Windows Azure. And for those of you that have experimented with Windows Azure before, you might have noticed that before you had to build your own application and deploy it in a Windows Azure hosted service, which is really a virtual machine dedicated to you. Now, not every application requires a complete server to run. Also, if you wanted to run Node.js or PHP, you had to do some tricks to get that running in there. And really, if you want to start small, if you want to start a small website like we did, you don't want to have a complete virtual machine reserved for you. Windows Azure Websites also allows you to deploy within seconds using FTP, JIT, or TFS. Whereas if you use the platform as a service component, the hosted services you may have experimented with, you may have noticed there that you have to wait up until, well, 10 to 20 minutes before your deployment is finished. That is because that service is really deploying a complete virtual machine for your application. While with Windows Azure websites, you're really just hosting your website in a shared environment, pushing to it, and it's literally up and running in seconds. You can start for free, and then after that, you can scale up as your traffic grows. And you can scale up by hosting your application on multiple shared machines, but you can also host your application on a reserved instance and really grow as your website grows as well. So Windows Azure websites, by default, if you deploy something in there, you will have one shared instance. That instance is not for you. There's a lot of websites on there. So if I host my website on there and you host it in there is a chance that both of our websites are on the same virtual machine in the Windows Azure data center. I can also scale it. I can move to two Windows Azure website instances, and then my website will be deployed on two virtual machines sitting in the Windows Azure data center, but still in a shared environment. The resources are shared with other websites as well. Now, if that's no longer enough, I can also switch to reserved mode. And if I switch to a reserved instance, what will happen is that the Windows Azure data center will spin up a virtual machine for me, and my website is moved to that reserved instance. So at this moment, I really have a complete web server running for my website on there. With those reserved instances, I can also scale. I can change it to two, and my website will be running on two instances in there. So it's really easy to scale out. And actually, it's also really easy to scale up if you want to do that. You can really very easily switch from one CPU to two CPUs to an 8-core machine if you really require it. Also, if you host multiple websites afterwards, your websites will all end up on your reserved machines. No websites from other users, but your websites will end up in the same virtual machines. It's a perfect ramp up if you want to start small. So if you're a startup and you're a really small business, Windows Azure websites are cheap. In fact, for now, you get 10 websites for free on Windows Azure. And from the moment your website starts growing big, from the moment you start gaining traction from the internet, you can scale up to 3 reserved instances for your websites. And if that still is not enough, you can switch to the hosted services and run in the platform as a service business, and you can really scale at will in there. So it's really easy to start cheap, really, really, really cheap, and then grow big the moment you require it. So let's give you a quick demo on Windows Azure websites. I'm going to log out from BrewBuddy and let's go to the new Windows Azure Management Portal. You see, BrewBuddy is running here under websites. I'm simply going to create a new website there. So let's say new website, quick create. You can also create one with a database, even MySQL. And I'm going to create a new one called ASP.conf. Let's hope that still exists. Yes. And create a new website. Now, this process will take a couple of seconds. You see, it's still creating the website, but after a couple of seconds, the website is ready and I can already navigate to it. So, if you go to asp.conf.azurewebsites.net, you will see this website that I'm creating. Of course, there's no content over there yet. How you can publish to this one? Well, you can use TFS. So, you can publish directly from your TFS server to Windows Azure websites. You can download a publish profile, which you can use in WebMatrix or in Visual Studio, or you can set up Git publishing, or you can even use FTP to publish your website on there. I'm going to select Git, and what will happen is that a Git repository is created for my website, and I will be able to use this one to publish my website. So if you have a couple of seconds, my repository has been created, and I can now push my website to this URL on there. So what I'm going to do is create a quick website. Let's open Visual Studio, create a new project in there, a new simple web application, ASP.NET. Let's create it. I'm not going to add anything in there. I'm just going to create a blank new and deploy that one to Windows Azure websites. So blank new project created. I'll add ASP.conf in the text. There we go. Next thing I'm going to do is go to my folder in which I created this website, open up a command prompt, and because I'm lazy and I don't know all the commands by heart, what I'm going to do is just copy all the commands from here, initialize my Git repository, commit my current application to my Git repository, and then publish it to Windows Azure websites. So I'm adding my website, committing the website to my local repository. And now, of course, I still have to upload it to Windows Azure. So that's with the following two commands. I'm going to push it, add my password in there, and this one will be deploying to my Git repository. In the background, you will also see that this Git repository screen will change. So from the moment my website has been uploaded to Git, you will see that my website's control panel, the portal on there, is starting to act crazy. So we've deployed, and you will see that the screen changes. It's saying deploying right now. And after a while, it will say this is the active deployment. So right now, if I go to my website, click this URL, you will see that my website is on there. Nope, that's not the one. There we are. Welcome to ASP.conf deployed through Git. Now, what's interesting is if you go to this deployment screen, you will see the steps that have been taken. I have deployed my application through Git without compiling it. And what you see is that my website project has been built by Windows Azure. So I can just upload my source code and Windows Azure will deploy it and compile it. Now, what's also interesting is I can even add unit tests, and if one unit test fails, the deployment will not take place, and my old website will still be up and running there. With websites, I can also monitor my website, so I can see the average CPU times, I can see the number of requests coming in, the data out, the data in, HTTP errors, and so on. I can tweak the configuration, so I can switch the .NET framework version if I want to. I can turn off PHP or not. If I want to run PHP, for example, I simply upload some PHP files using Git or FTP, and this one will be running on my Windows Azure website. I can also specify a host name. Now, currently, because it's still a preview, you cannot add a custom host name to one of those shared websites. So you have to switch to a reserved website if you want to use a custom host name. But I'm pretty sure that probably in the final version, you will be able to add your own host name even to a shared instance. I can also configure diagnostics in here. I can configure failed request tracing. I can change my web config, the app settings that are sitting in there. I can change my connection strings, default documents, basically whatever you want to manage, you can do it through this portal. Another fun thing is I can scale. So right now I'm on this shared mode, and like I showed you in the slides, I can simply scale up to 3 instances, and I will be scaling to 3 shared instances just by saving it. And it literally takes a couple of seconds before my website is also deployed to 2 other instances. Afterwards, I can scale back to 1. I can switch to reserved if I want. I can also specify the number of cores I want in my reserved instance. So it's really, really easy to start small and grow big with your application. And if you no longer need your website, well, you can simply click the delete button and your website will be gone again in seconds. So it's really, really powerful concept using those websites, and it's really fun that they do the build of your application for you and keep track of unit tests with that. Okay, sensors. So we deployed our website, and it's just a regular ASP.NET MVC website, ASP.NET 4, using Twitter Bootstrap with a small customization in the hero unit. So you saw the beer background. But it's really just a simple ASP.NET MVC website running on Windows Azure websites. Now, for those sensors, I want to connect them to my application as well. And I'm going to use the service bus for that and the access control service to keep track of who can connect to my service bus and who can't. For those of you who don't know Windows Azure Service Bus, Windows Azure Service Bus has 2 main features. The first feature is the relay, in which you can relay WCF services through the Windows Azure Service Bus. Second feature, which we are using in BrewBuddy, is the feature of queues, topics, and subscriptions. So if you are using the relay service, here's a situation where you would use a service bus relay. You have a client, you have a service, or you have multiple clients and multiple services, whatever you want. And those are firewalled. Your client can't access the service directly, and your service can't access the clients directly. What Service Bus Relay does is it offers you some additional bindings for WCF, and it enables your clients to connect to an endpoint in Windows Azure Service Bus. Also, your service will connect to Windows Azure Service Bus, and this one goes through most firewalls. If you have HTTP or HTTPS access to the outside internet, your service will be able to connect to the Service Bus Relay. Now, the interesting part in there is that both parties make an outgoing connection to the Windows Azure Service Bus, and the Service Bus will then relay traffic between both endpoints. So there's no direct connection in there, but you can just connect outside, and Windows Azure will make sure the connection is there. Then the one we are using in BrewBuddy is the topics and subscriptions. So topics and subscriptions are an extension on top of queues. So you know what a queue is, you put in messages, and you read out messages from that queue. Topics and subscriptions are similar, except for the fact that subscriptions can filter on the messages. So if your subscription is only interested in messages from a specific sensor or from a specific customer, you can filter those in subscriptions. Now what we do is our sensor, every 20 seconds, it connects to the service bus and publishes its data on a topic. Then in our backend, we have a couple of workers, and those workers also connect to a subscription. They really subscribe to sensor events. And what happens is the sensor just keeps pushing data into the queue, and my worker will be consuming that queue and process it and store it in our database to make sure that we have our temperature monitoring on the website. Now, there's some interesting things there. Our workers can scale independently. So, for example, if we have a lot of sensors, what we can do is simply add more workers and it will work. They can also scale down. So, if we have a lot of sensors and we want to reduce our costs, we can simply remove some of those workers. And what will happen is the queue will contain more messages because it will take longer to process all those messages in the queue. But my worker will still be able to handle the load in its own pace, so I can scale independently. I can also fail independently. If one of my workers goes down, no problem. Messages will remain sitting in the queue if I only had one worker. If I have multiple workers, no problem, that one worker's work will be taken by another one of those workers. I see a question on there. Do you know if the Azure team is planning any Azure management add-ins for Visual Studio? Well, if you install the latest Windows Azure SDKs in Visual Studio, you will see that there's some sort of management and there's a basic form of that being created, but it's not yet yet as big as with Amazon, for example. But they're working on something. Okay, back to Service Bus. So workers can scale and fail independently from each other. And as you've seen in our architecture, our sensors connect to the service bus directly as well. So there's no layer in between. What you would typically think you would do is you have your sensor, it connects to your website, to a WCF service or an API or something, and that website will actually put the messages inside a queue. Now that's fine if you have just a handful of sensors. But if you have a lot of sensors, that layer will become your bottleneck because the sensors will send all that data to your website and your website will have to handle the load from all those sensors. So if you have 1 million sensors, for example, you will have to have a lot of web rolls running just to copy the sensor data from an incoming request to the service bus queue. So we decided to not use a layer in between and have the sensors connect directly to Windows Azure Service Bus, which makes it cheaper for us because we don't have to scale our websites for every sensor that's being added. But it's also, well, Service Bus has been designed for scale already, so why not make use of that one? So let's just use the Service Bus directly from within our sensors. Now, what about authentication and authorization? Well, if you want to connect to Windows Azure Access Control Service, you will have to have some form of authentication in there. So, by default, the Windows Azure Service Bus is connected to the Windows Azure Access Control Service. And whenever you want to connect to the Service Bus, you will have to request a token to access the service from Access Control Service. Service Bus will use that token to authenticate what you can do. So there's typically three claims that you can have on Service Bus, which are first of all send, second of all read, and the third one is manage. So you can really decide which user or which sensor can do which operation on the Service Bus. So it would be nice if we just had our sensors connected to the Service Bus and just give them the send claim. So not the read or the manage claim. Interesting part is also that if I want to allow or disallow a sensor on our solution, I can just configure it in the access control service, and the service bus will grant or deny access based on the credentials and the configuration that's sitting in Windows Azure Access Control Service. So I'm going to quickly show you how Windows Azure Service Bus manages this internally. So here's my Windows Azure Service Bus Access Control Service. I have to sign in again. And for those of you who have been using the Service Bus before, you may have noticed already that every time you create a Service Bus, there's also an associated Access Control service namespace being created. And that is because of the fact that the Service Bus relies on Access Control Service to authenticate all the users using this Access Control service. You will see your relying party applications in there, and you will see that your Service Bus account is there. So your Service Bus is relying on this Access Control service to authenticate your users. Next thing you will see is a bunch of service identities. So what we do is every time we have a sensor, we simply add it in here as a service identity, and then we can grant it access to something. So every time we add a sensor in our solution, we register it as a service identity. We don't have to do it manually through this portal. There's an API for it as well. If you search NuGet for the package called Fluent ACS, that's a nice NuGet package which is sitting there and which enables you to use the API of the access control service to create a service identity in here. So from the moment you have a service identity, and keep track of the ID in here, it's B917 something. From the moment you have that one, you can also add a rule. So whenever someone connects to service bus, their grants are being parsed through a rule group. So what will happen is, whenever my B917 sensor comes to service bus to authenticate, you will see that I'm adding a rule to it. So whenever the name identifier, so the user ID of my user, is this one, the B917 blah blah blah, the sensor ID, I generate an output claim name, which is net Windows Service Bus Action, something Service Bus uses internally to distinguish the actual privileges you have on the Service Bus, and I grant it the value sent. So every sensor I add is being parsed through this rule group, and the rule group will add a sent claim for that sensor in its claims that it uses to connect to the Service Bus. Now, from the moment I unregister a sensor, this sent claim, of course, disappears, and my sensor will no longer be able to connect to the service bus and add data onto it. So it's really, really easy to authenticate who can access your service bus in there. Again, also my sensors are only retrieving the sent claim. So my sensors will never be able to read data from this queue. So they will never be able to read data from other sensors or other data that is passing through my service bus namespace. Now, of course, my application does have read access, and you see again in this default rule group that these three claims are for the owner of the service bus, and the owner, of course, gets all privileges on the service bus in there. Okay, so the architecture becomes a little more complicated. We have our public website, we have our database, we have our sensor giving data to the sensor data service bus topic, and there's a worker processing that data and dumping the averages into our database. We also have our access control service serving as some kind of the man in the middle. And my service bus topic will use the access control service to authenticate to really validate the claims the sensor is sending. So what will happen is, through the public website, I will register a sensor into the access control service. My sensor will use the access control service to authenticate itself and to retrieve a token that it can pass to the service bus. And that token will contain all the claims, all the rules it's entitled to. And then the sensor uses that token to connect to the service bus topic. And the service bus topic just has to check for a valid signature in there to check if the sensor bus topic can be accessed by the sensor. I see a question in here. Is there a way to script all these steps? Well, Deborah, yes, there is a way to script all those steps, and I will show you right after this slide. So how do you link a sensor? Well, every sensor has its own unique sensor ID, and you can add it as an identity to access control service and grant it a send claim through an API. So I will show you how you can do it. I have my sensor running here in my task tray, and you will see that it is now linked to brewbuddy.net, and my sensor ID is on there as well. So you see it in here. Now what I can do is use that sensor ID and go to brewbuddy again. So let's go to brewbuddy. Let's log in. There we go. And my sensor is currently linked to one of those brews. I think it's this one. Yes, and I can unlink this sensor. Now, if you recall, in my Windows Azure Access Control Service configuration, you see my service identities. and my sensor ID is in there. Now let's unlink this sensor. Yes, I'm sure that I want to unlink it. And you will see that the service identity is now gone. And in the rule groups, you will also see that there's no more rule for that specific sensor. Fun thing is also, if I click on my sensor, you will see that it's no longer linked to brewbuddy.net. So the fact that I revoked that send claim through the access control service basically notified my sensor that it's no longer linked to brewbuddy and that it should not send data to any brew. Now, of course, I can go to my recipes again, brew one of those Rochefort's, which is, by the way, an excellent beer. Belgian beer, of course. It's fermenting. I can save it. I can link a temperature sensor to this newly created brew, link the sensor. And again, you will see in service identities, my sensor ID has been added again, and my sensor is now linked to BrewBuddy again. So it's really, really fast. And you now also see that my worker role, I'm going to show it, is now processing messages coming in from this sensor. So it's really, really easy to manage your service, your access control service namespace from within code. So I will show you the code for this one as well. So if I go to my brew solution, I have a brew service in there, which is this one. I'm going to make my screen a little bit larger. And my brew service has a method called link sensor and unlink sensor. So what happens if I link a sensor is that I'm connecting to my service management namespace, and I can do that using a service management wrapper, which comes from the excellent NuGet package called Fluent ACS. So if you want to install that one, that's install package Fluent ACS. Now the service management wrapper takes three parameters, your service management namespace, of course, one of those service identities who has a manage privilege, and one of those service identities private key to connect to this management namespace. From then on, this client is simply an OData proxy. So in there, you can query the rules and check if there's already an existing rule containing an existing sensor. You can create a new identity like this. So I create a new service identity. I give it a description. The name will be my sensor ID. I also add a service identity key, which is just basically some sort of password for my sensor. I can give it a start date and an end date. So whenever my sensor tries to connect to my application, within 2 months, my sensor will be revoked access to my service bus namespace. Afterwards, I simply add those objects, save changes in batch. I can add the claims. So it's really easy to just programmatically manage your Windows Azure Access Control service namespace. And of course, because we are managing that one, we can simply make sure that our service bus grants or denies access for specific sensors. Okay, now as the French say, make everyone happy, we need an API. We need an API. So what is an API? Well, an API is a simple software to software interface. And an API is used to connect multiple programs with each other. So you have probably been using Twitter, you have been using Facebook, you have been using LinkedIn, you have been using a lot of websites who are exposing APIs. And a lot of applications on your iPad or on your Windows Phone 7 are using APIs to connect to software that's sitting somewhere on the internet. Now, an API is simply just a contract between software and developers. And typically, an API just describes all the functionalities it has. It describes the constraints. So for example, on Twitter, there's a constraint that you cannot access the API for more than a couple of number or a specific number of actions per day. So it's just a contract on how a developer of specific software can connect to your software-to-software interface. Now, the idea of an API is to open up your services to other developers, be it a public API on which you don't have to authenticate or something, or be it a private API. So what you can do is expose your data or expose your services on the internet as an API, and other developers can use it in their applications as well. Now, do you need an API? Well, for BrewBuddy, we decided we need an API. We are currently in a smartphone generation and a tablet generation, and everyone has a couple of screens, probably a computer, probably a phone, probably a tablet. I hear some sound on the live meeting as well. Let's just see if I can mute that one. There we go. The idea is we needed an API. Why? Because there's a lot of smartphones out there, there's a lot of tablets out there, there's a lot of computers out there, and most of those things are going to have an application to do something. Now, what I don't want to do is have my computer in my kitchen whenever I'm brewing. It would be nice if I just had a Windows Phone 7 application or an application on my iPad on which I can enter the initial readings of the brew that I'm creating. So why do you need an API? Well, simply to allow flexibility in providing content. You want to allow other people to build an application on top of your service and to really expand your service into multiple applications. So you can see this in the number of Twitter clients, for example. Yes, you can use the Twitter website, but you can also use a lot of Twitter clients on different mobile platforms to, well, basically send messages on Twitter. Why did they do it? Because they wanted to reach a larger scale than the one they had with their website. Not everyone is connected to a browser continuously, so you want to have a native application which is also able to work with your data and to work with your service. So the main idea of an API and why you would want to have an API is just to increase your scale and to increase your reach to a larger number of potential users. And if you have a nicely documented API like Twitter has, for example, people will start building applications on top of that. You don't have to pay them to build those applications, but they will still drive traffic through your application and through your services, albeit not through the public website, but then again. So the idea is build richer applications and reach more people. If there's an application for BrewBuddy on all those platforms, I can imagine a lot of more people will be using BrewBuddy from their native device as opposed to just using BrewBuddy from within their browser. So what you want is a lot of platforms being able to use your application. Now, in the ASP.NET platform, you can use the newly created ASP.NET Web API to build your API. ASP.NET Web API is part of ASP.NET MVC 4, which is currently in release candidates, but it's stable enough to use in production, I think. And ASP.NET Web API is a framework to build HTTP services which expose REST. Now, the fun thing about ASP.NET Web API is that it's inspired on MVC. So the idea is you create a controller which has action methods that respond to certain HTTP methods. So for example, if I want to retrieve data, I will create a get method. I will implement a get method which users can call to retrieve data from my API. If I want to create an interface where people can post data, well, I simply respond to the HTTP post verb. And my API will accept that request and do something with it and probably save something in my database. Another interesting part on ASP.NET MVC Web API is the fact that it supports content negotiation. So a lot of APIs out there are using XML. A lot of them are using JSON. What Web API does is it allows you to build your API. And based on what the user requests, so in HTTP, there's a header you can send which tells the server what type of content you expect. Well, based on that header, people will, the API will respond to the request coming in, be it XML, be it JSON, whatever. There's also OData query support, so if you expose your API and you return an iQueryable from some API, your user will be able to query that iQueryable from within his browser. There's also model binding and validation and routing, just like with ASP.NET MVC. So you are able to build routes and to validate the model that's coming into your API. There's also action filters, just like in ASP.NET MVC. If your API requires authentication, for example, you can simply add an authorize attribute on top of that API, and your application will require users of the API to authenticate. I'm being notified that there's a question. Is there a way to script all these steps? Well, I think we've covered that one. If not, feel free to ask the question again. So there we go. So let's craft a quick API within BrewBuddy. So what you can do is within your application, you can simply create a new API by, let's find it, creating a new controller. So every controller you want to expose as an API should inherit API controller. So let's say I want to create a class called sample controller. This one will inherit API controller, which is of course with a minor O. That's your API. From now on, my website, because I added a route to my API in my global.asx, from now on, if someone requests /API/v1/sample, this API will respond. How will it respond? Well, based on the HTTP keyword I'm giving my API. So by default, if you want to return data, so if you want to allow people to just get data from your API, what you will have to respond to is the get keyword. Now it's really easy to do that in the ASP.NET Web API. You simply create a new method called get, and that's the one responding to a get request. Now, of course, I don't want to return void. I want to return a string, for example. And what I'm going to return is ASP.conf is awesome. That's a great API, I think, but you get the picture. You can simply create your controller, return any type you want, as long as the JSON serializer or the XML serializer can serialize it afterwards. Now, if I require authentication for this controller, I can simply add an authorize attribute, just the same way you do it in ASP.NET MVC. If you want to intercept calls to this controller and you want to build your own logging interceptor, for example, you can also create your own action filter and respond to the fact that an action method is being called in your API. So let's run this one. Bear with me because my computer sometimes is slow, sometimes is fast. You will see my application is now running on localhost, and I'm going to use Fiddler to access my API. Now, before doing that, I just want to show you where this API has been linked. In my global.asx, where is it? You will see that there's a lot of stuff happening there, but you will also see that I'm mapping an HTTP route, which is this one. This HTTP route basically tells the routing engine in ASP.NET that whenever a request comes in for something called API/v1/some controller, it should find a controller of the type API controller and have it handled by the ASP.NET Web API. Now you'll also notice when you create a new Web API project in ASP.NET Web API, you will see that this V1 is missing in the default route. I would say add this V1 immediately, because one of the things you have to think about with your API is versioning. So if you want to create an API, you will have to make sure that your API is versioned. And if you create breaking changes, you increase the version number and keep your old API running as well. So people using that one, not everyone who has built a WP7 or an iPad application will upgrade to your newest API immediately. So keep those two versions running, but on a separate URL. So I have this route defined. I have my sample controller. So now let's use Fiddler to do a request to my application. I'm pretty sure that you will not be able to see this one, so I'm going to use zoom it for a second. What I'm going to do in Fiddler is getting data from my sample controller. I'm issuing a get command to my sample controller and adding some request headers in there. Now the fun thing that I can do is I can say accept. And I can add application/JSON, and my application will respond with the JSON data format. Now, if my application is using a different format, say XML, for example, what I can do is simply say text XML, and my API will respond with an XML format. Now, the fun thing is those media formatters, as they are called, can be extended as well. So if someone asks this sample controller for a type image slash PNG, for example, what my API can do is maybe respond with a picture of a specific brew or of a bottle or something. So based on the HTTP keywords, your API can respond differently if you want. In my BrewBuddy, I'm going back to my sample controller and I'm going to add a breakpoint in there. So in Fiddler, let's issue this request and I'm getting a 404. No type was found that matches the controller named sample. What have I done or what have I not done? I think I'm still running on an old version of this controller or something because the symbols have not been loaded. Let's try it one more time. It may be because of the fact that my computer is sometimes a little bit crazy, so I'm going to issue that request one more time, getting a 404 again. For some reason, it's not discovering my newly created controller, and I think that has to do with the fact that I'm running my monitor, which is in the same project, etc. So I'm basically not able to update my application. But you get the picture. The idea is if I do a get to this API will respond using the get methods. If I want to post something to my API, well, it's as simple as creating a void called post, and well, if you want to accept a string called recipe, you can just do something with it as well. I'm seeing a comment called clean and recompile. Let's do that once. Not sure if it will work. Clean succeeded. Thanks, Joel, if this works. Okay, it's running. I'm issuing this request one more time and my API is still not responding. So there's something funky going on with my local web server, but that's no problem. Not a problem at all because I have a working API as well, which I will demo in a second. Now the fun thing about those APIs is it's really simple to build them, but how would you go with authentication? Will you add basic authentication? Will you add Windows authentication? How will you authenticate the users accessing your service? Well, the idea is a lot of APIs use OAuth, and OAuth is a system where an application requests your application to access an API on behalf of one of your users. And you can do that using the access control service in Windows Azure as well. So the idea there is that the initial call, the initial authorization step in which you have to choose yes or no, whether or not you allow access to your API or not, that part will be handled by BrewBuddy. The other part of OAuth will be handled by access control service. So the management of access and refresh tokens, for those of you who know OAuth, will be managed by ACS. Now, if you don't know OAuth, I will give you a quick flow of what we're going to build. So here's what we have. We have an API consumer. And whenever you want an application to be able to access your application, you grant that application, so the API consumer, a client ID and a client secret. The client ID and the client secret are not user specific. It's just this application who is wanting to access my application can access my API using a specific client ID and a client secret. Consider it like a username and a password on the application level for the API consumer. We have brewbuddy.net, and BrewBuddy contains one of those pages. Like for example, if you install a new Twitter client and you have navigate to Twitter, Twitter will ask you if you want to allow access to your account details for that specific application. Well, that's what we're going to do with brewbuddy.net as well. So we want our API consumer to make an initial call to brewbuddy.net to authorize the application for a specific user. So here's the idea. My API consumer calls into brewbuddy.net for the initial authorization step. So what will happen is the API consumer passes its client ID and client secrets to brewbuddy.net. And brewbuddy.net will, if you're not logged in already, will ask you to log in as a user, so in your browser window. After you've done that, BrewBuddy will ask you if you want to allow this API consumer to act on your behalf. So basically, what will happen is your API consumer is making an initial call to get consent of your user whether or not the API consumer can use brewbuddy.net in your name. Now, from the moment you click yes, what will happen is that BrewBuddy calls into the access control service to register an OAuth delegation. So what a delegation is simply in access control service, we are saying that this specific client ID can act on behalf of the user that's accessing BrewBuddy. From the moment that has been done, ACS will return an initial authorization code to brewbuddy.net, and BrewBuddy simply returns that one to my API consumer. And from that moment on, the API consumer can use that specific token to access or to ask access to the access control service. So the next step that will happen is from the moment the API consumer has the code present, the API consumer will call into access control service to acquire an access token. So an access token is the initial token with which it can access brewbuddy.net. And that token contains, again, claims like, for example, the username, the age, the birth date, whatever you want to add in there. Access control service responds to you with a claim set, responds to you with a signature for that claim set, and responds to you with a refresh token. Now, the access token can be used to call into BrewBuddy on the user's behalf. The refresh token can be used to call into access control service again whenever that access token expires. So you can basically tell an access token to expire after 1 hour, after a couple of months, or whatever. So, for example, LinkedIn does this. If you want to access the LinkedIn API, what LinkedIn does is it asks the user for what period you want to allow access to this specific application. You can say infinite, but you can also say for 1 week or 1 month. So that's why this refresh token is being used. From the moment my API consumer has an access token from ACS, it will be able to access my API on BrewBuddy. So let's give you a quick demo. By the way, in this demo, I have created a Windows Azure.acs.oauth2 package on NuGet. So if you want to build something like this, build the exact same scenario as I've explained previously, you can simply install this package into your API project, and you will be able to use ACS to manage your API access. So let's give you a quick demo. In my ACS, and I have used my same service bus ACS. You can use a separate namespace as well. In my ACS, I have registered my brew recipes as an application. So this is an application which has a client ID, and that client ID is, let's find it again. That client ID is this one. So whenever my brew recipes application is trying to access the API on BrewBuddy, it will have to present this one as the client ID. And if I click further, it will also have to provide this password as the client secret. From the moment you have that, you can ask for authorization to the API on BrewBuddy. Now, I have that application running, and that's this one. It's really simple. It just will connect to BrewBuddy. Now, what this application does, and I will show you the source code, what this application does is in the home controller, it will issue a connect request to my BrewBuddy website. So the initial authorization step, which is this one, will happen against BrewBuddy. While afterwards, the fact that I want to retrieve an authorization claim or an access token will be handled by my service bus namespace, not by the root namespace, but simply by using the OAuth2 endpoint in there. My API site in BrewBuddy is very simple. I have a recipes controller, and that one simply returns the recipes for a specific username. Now, of course, I want to be able to acquire this username. So what will happen is I will have to authorize to this API. Now, this authorization will not happen using basic authentication or Windows authentication or whatsoever. It will happen using an OAuth access token, which my client will retrieve from Windows Azure Service Bus. Sorry, from Access Control Service. So when I'm going to log out from RewBuddy first so you can see the entire flow. In my application, I can click to connect. And what will happen is I'm being redirected to BrewBuddy, as you can see. BrewBuddy asks me if I want to log in, and I can log in. There we go. And it asks me if my brew recipes can access resources on my behalf. I can say no, take me back to the application, and this application will not get any authorization token. I can connect again and say yes, it's okay. And from the moment I click yes, well, BrewBuddy will add a delegation to the access control service, and my API can use that one to retrieve access tokens. And as you can see, from the moment I do that, my local service will be able to access my recipes on there. BrewBuddy no longer has to take care about access tokens or refresh tokens. Whenever my brew recipes wants to access something on my behalf, it just queries access control service for a claim. And if access control service grants that claim, my brew recipes can access BrewBuddy. Now, how is this secure? Well, BrewBuddy reads in that claim, and BrewBuddy checks the signature on that claim. So whenever someone tries to forge the access control token, well, he will not get access to my BrewBuddy API because the claim has not been issued by the access control service. On the BrewBuddy side, it's really simple to do this OAuth authentication. You have to install the package I just mentioned. And that package installs some configuration settings into your web config, which is the signing key, which you can get from the ACS namespace, your relying party name and your relying party realm, your service namespace, and some user who can manage that service namespace using the API. And that's really it. You don't have to do anything beyond that to use this flow and use this flow in your application. So it's really easy to implement OAuth authentication using this in your project. So it's well, feel free to install the package and experiment with it. I'm desperately looking for feedback on that package. If you want the sources of it, for example, you can also find those on my GitHub account, which is this one. You can contribute, you can test it, whatever you want. And there's also a manual on how you can install it into your application. So feel free to experiment with it. Okay, so we have a website running on websites. We have a worker role. We have service bus to authenticate sensors. And we have an API for BrewBuddy. So we're ready to go live. And if you want to be a home brewer, use BrewBuddy as you please. Keep in mind, Windows Azure websites are really easy to use. You can deploy to them using Git. You can deploy to them using TFS, using FTP, or whatever you want. They start really, really cheap. They start for free, in fact, currently. And you can scale them. You can scale on shared instances. If those grow too small for your website, you can scale them on dedicated instances. And if those grow out again, you can simply switch to Windows Azure Platform as a Service and host your application there. Combine with the services at will. So if you want to use SQL Azure as the backend for your Windows Azure website, no problem. Have fun with it. If you want to use the service bus, access control, or whatever, you can also use that one with Windows Azure websites. You can use the service bus for asynchrony and scale. So what we did was our sensors are pumping their data into the service bus topic, and my workers are consuming this at their own pace. If there's a lot of sensors and I simply have one worker, well, okay, the queue will grow and data will be less real time, but my worker will not crash because there's a high load on there. The queue will just simply queue all those messages and my worker will consume it in its own pace. The worker can also crash. Messages will simply stay in the queue and my worker can continue working afterwards. I'm using access control for devices. So devices have to register with access control before they are able to access the service bus. And you can automate that using the Fluent ACS package, for example, that's sitting on NuGet. You can simply craft your own application code to instrument the access control service and manage your applications and your users that are sitting in there. We've also created an API using the ASP.NET Web API and the Windows Azure Access Control Service for OAuth delegation. There's a NuGet package for that. Feel free to ask me on Twitter how it works. Feel free to check my GitHub if you want to experiment with it. It's really super easy to protect your Web API and to really delegate all the hard stuff to Windows Azure Access Control. And your website simply has to provide the yes, no button if it allows access to the API or not. I've also listed some related sessions on ASP.conf today. So there's an interesting one right after this one, I think, which is called Test First and Functional First with Web API. So if you want to know more about Web API, go to that one. There's an Ask the Experts panel on Web API, for example. Feel free to ask them questions as well. There's an Azure SDK session and an introduction to ASP.NET Web API later today. Tomorrow, there's a From Zero to Hero session on Windows Azure websites. So you will learn how Windows Azure websites work. If you've seen enough, feel free to check the advanced ASP.NET Web API session. And afterwards, there's also a lightweight approach to building web-based APIs as well. With that, if you have any questions, feel free to ask them using the Q&A button that is sitting in live meeting or to post them on the Jabber room. I see a question coming in. When publishing a website using Git, can you use GitHub or does your repository need to be hosted on Azure? Good question. Currently, you cannot use GitHub. You have to host it on Azure. What you can do, however, is use GitHub for source control. And the moment you think I'm ready to deploy, you simply push to your Windows Azure repository as well, which will deploy to Windows Azure websites. If you navigate to my blog and search for GitHub for Windows, actually I'm going to do that one. There we are. I have been using GitHub for Windows as a client for Windows Azure websites as well. So if you're not a command line geek, you can simply use the GitHub for Windows package to publish stuff to Windows Azure websites. So there's a blog post on that one available. Any other questions? I don't see any questions coming in. Feel free to find me in the ASP.conf room 4 on Jabber or on Twitter if you have additional questions. With that, I thank you for being here. Feel free to rate this session. It's on there. And if you need my blog, it's blog.martinbaliao.be. But the slides will be online afterwards, so you can find my blog as well. If you search my name, you will find it as well. Don't forget to rate my session. The link is on the slides here, and thank you for attending.